You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Yo, what is going down? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the movies!
show me the X rating of the original film. Show me the penis. Like, let's see it.
Yeah, that too.
Let's see it.
Show me the penis!
Let's see it, Dirk.
See that thing, Mark!
Yeah, Dirk.
What up? I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Raymond.
Hello.
And we've got Ryan.
Sup, film fans.
And this week we're going to be talking about the, was it an instant classic? It's definitely a classic now. Boogie Nights, directed by PTA Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Mark Wahlberg, Julianne Moore, Burt Reynolds, Don Cheadle, John C. Reilly, William H. Macy, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Heather Graham. All right, as always, we're going to go around and get first impressions. What was it like the first time we watched this movie? What was it like on repeated viewings and then this most recent viewing? But first, I do want to just give a quick shout out to remind everybody out there that we have a Twitter. So please go follow us. It's SMTM_POD, SMTM_pod. And also, we're live. So please make sure that you are engaging with us in the chats. We're going to engage with y'all. If you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever it is, but you want to get involved in the live goodness, of course you can do that. We always go live at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Tuesday. Enough admin stuff. First impressions, Raymond. What was it like the first time you saw this, and what was it like repeated viewings and then this most recent viewing? Go!
I can't even remember the very first time that I saw this. This is one of my favorite movies. I've watched it quite a few times at this point. I think the first time I saw it was in high school. I remember getting my hands on the two-disc special edition DVD that I think the thumbnail art that we used for this episode is actually from that that DVD cover. Yeah, it was just a really fresh and exciting movie. It's always a pleasure to rewatch. I love Paul Thomas Anderson. I think I've mentioned on the show he's probably my my favorite living filmmaker. So it's always a pleasure to review and discuss his work. So I'm excited to talk to you guys about it.
Okay, first thing then, where does Boogie Nights rank in his filmography for you?
For me, you know, I'm actually not as crazy about the first half of his filmography. I think Hard Eight through Punch Drunk Love are all really solid, but Hard Eight, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love, I'm not as hot on. I think Boogie Nights is really, really self-assured, and I love the energy that it has. But I'm a bit more partial to his later work. I've got to say, like Phantom Thread, There Will Be Blood. And then Boogie Nights is right in the hunt for third.
Okay. All right. Ryan, what about you, brother?
Well, same. One of my favorite movies ever. I'd put it in my top 10, probably.
Wow.
I've seen it countless times. Love the shit out of it. One of the best modern movies. I don't know. You can gush about this movie all day. I definitely had a very fun viewing my first one. It was before I could even drive, and I walked all the way to Target, which from my house, which was pretty far. But I was like, for some reason, I really wanted to go on a walk. And my mom was very strict about what movies I could watch as a kid. So there was no, you know, there was no me seeing anything like Boogie Nights, of course.
Right.
But then I went to Target and I bought it on VHS. By myself, and then I went snuck at home and I watched it on VHS in my room with the door locked, and I was blown away. And I think that maybe kind of made it better too, because I was like kind of on edge, you know. And it's about this like, you know, salacious, you know, sex scene, obviously, where there's a million scenes. Anyway, the movie rocked. And the first time I saw it, I don't think I fully comprehended how awesome it was. And it was, you know, then later on, as I got way more in the movies, like I was like, and we go back and watch it. And I, every time I'm kind of just blown away at how everything comes together and how he fit. Like, not only, it really is one of those firing on all cylinder movies, it, like just how he directed it. This movie, I think, inspires young people to be, you know, every PTA movie does, but definitely this one, I think, just, you know, it's a film fan's film, basically. It's got all these cool references. You can kind of pick it apart endlessly. But if you really, and I hope we do that today, but yeah, if you really break down the structure and how he's filming these scenes and stuff, and when he chooses to do really cool cinematic photography stuff, and then when he kind of just chooses to let the scene play and let these amazing actors he has just kind of roll with it. Like, it's a masterclass, if you will, on, I think, directing a really complicated ensemble movie, which is hard to do already, but then he weaves it together so well. Like, I'm never bored watching this movie, and it's fucking 3 hours long, and I just want more the whole time. And then the climax, to me, is one of the best scenes, like, ever. Anyway, this is just a great movie.
The climax of a film about climaxes is the best. Is
yes.
How many weird terrible puns happen. Are we going to use in the course of this thing? Yeah, look, this is one of those.
Oh, a lot.
This is one of those films that I feel like even if you haven't seen it, you've seen it. Especially if you're somebody that's a film student or anyone who's studied video essays, because you know, for me, there's that famous shot that everybody likes to talk about during the pool scene where it focuses on two people and then the camera just pans in. It's the long one shot, right? Where then it just goes and it focuses on two other people and then it follows, you know, the woman into the water and then it goes underwater. And so there's things like that that are just like iconic sequences. I feel like the scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman when he kisses Dirk Eddy, I think that's one of the ones that has been kind of like talked about a lot. I mean, there's so many elements of this that have become iconic that it's one of those things that I feel like you see even if you haven't seen it. But even if you do that, even if you know about this film, I don't think that actually encapsulates what this film is. Like, we use this word so often, like a je ne sais quoi, or that there's like a something special. This film just has like a magic about it, right? There's something about the style, the immersive camera techniques, the unique camera techniques, certain interesting editing approaches that kind of just get thrown in there to kind of like mix things up. But it never feels arbitrary. It always feels like it fits exactly with the tone of wherever they are in the unfolding of the story. The acting performances are fantastic. And I don't know, this film, it just seems to have some magic about it. And sometimes it can be so seamless or it can work so well that you forget how fucking hard it is to make a film that works like this, right? Like we can talk about Paul Thomas Anderson and say that he's, you know, one of, if not the greatest living filmmaker at the moment, right? Or let's say American filmmaker at the moment, at the very least. And you can kind of say that and you almost forget what is required to even have that kind of title. And so for me, I think watching this film, I've been thinking a lot about that. Like, why did this film just work so well? Besides the fact that I think it has some really amazing themes that we can unpack about sex, about relationships, about family, about the 1970s and the transition into the 1980s. And then, maybe even from a sort of more meta perspective, shouts to Jared, the old host. We love Jared here at Wisecrack, right? The meta perspective, let's get meta. We used to have a button, remember, Ryan? The meta button.
Oh yeah. Inception horn.
Shouts to Jared, who, like, the meta idea is this transition from film and cinema to videotape, which is PTA also one of those guys that bemoans the transition from film to digital as well? Is that one of the
he's very much people should go watch. I think his quote is like, yeah, like the experience of people watching pictures exposed through light onto a onto a wall should never go away.
Yeah.
So I think he is kind of a film purist in that sense. I don't know how, you know, what he thinks digitally.
He's not as outspoken a disciple of like film as a capture and exhibition format as someone like Christopher Nolan or Quentin Tarantino, who's probably the most vocal of those disciples. I think sometimes to his detriment. That's a totally different conversation. What I really love about Paul Thomas Anderson is that while he has the luxury and privilege of being able to work on his kind of preferred format, shooting on film, and even recently premiering Phantom Thread, his last feature, in 70mm in a handful of theaters, he is someone who is, by all accounts, always putting his neck out for independent filmmakers and maintaining a sense of like he has more of an embrace towards the democratizing effects of digital
media. I was gonna say, yeah, he's not trying to gatekeep so much, which is something
yeah.
that let's talk about this on the other side of the recap, because this is one of the themes that
Absolutely.
I want to bring up,
but just
there is,
so
no, this is great. So just as like to kind of god damn it, what's the fucking word I'm looking for where you foretell
foreshadowing
something? Yes. Foreshadow.
Just to tease that.
I forgot to give my own ranking of where this falls in my PTA.
Oh yes, I'm sorry.
Thing, and
yeah,
you
yeah,
did
where
too.
Where is this in?
Well,
yeah,
to
yeah,
me,
where is this in the? Yeah.
It sounds like me and Raymond are on opposite ends of the spectrum of PTA, because to me this is the
you
ultimate
first half.
I definitely prefer. Yes, the answer is yes. But Boogie Nights number one by far. Then I'm going to go There Will Be Blood, which I guess that's in his second half of his career. To me, it's kind of, I guess it's in the middle. But then
it's kind of the transition.
Yeah. And then I'm
going to
go
the filmmaker he is now.
Yeah, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love. And it's not that I don't like his new stuff. I do. I think it's super interesting. Like Phantom Thread was super interesting. I wouldn't call it a classic by any stretch, you know, compared to these others. And then Master, I kind of put in the same boat. And Inherent Vice, I deplore. I hate that.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah. And I want to, shake him. I'm like, what were you thinking? So that's definitely at the bottom. And then Heart 8, he's obviously got some growing pains. And I think even the version I saw, he doesn't fully even subscribe to. So that's my list.
Yeah, so this is top three for me. My favorite is There Will Be Blood. And for me, it's not even close. I mean, There Will Be Blood for me is a top 10 film. I just think that it is a masterpiece from top to bottom. And it covers an era of American history that I'm very fascinated with as well. I'm really interested in stories of like Americana and stuff like that. And this one, a lot of PTA's films are exploring like L.A., right? And I think that's really interesting, but being from LA, I don't care as much about LA as people a lot of times do. Like, that's why I don't like the film La La Land that much, because I'm like, Jesus Christ, okay, LA. But LA, fucking whatever, man.
Austin,
it's a place.
There are plenty of reasons to not like La La Land.
We don't need to be bashing. I don't hate the film. I just am tired of LA patting itself on the back, right?
Sure.
Like, I'm like, whatever, dude. Like, come on. I'm from Orange County anyway, really, more than anything. So, you know, but no, here nor there. So for me, There Will Be Blood, but this is definitely top two or three, I think, for me.
I think you guys have hit on something that there, like we mentioned before, There Will Be Blood seems to be the moment when he starts working in like a decidedly different idiom. For better or worse, I think there is a pretty, there's a pretty clear sort of bisection between those first four and the latter four of his career.
Yeah.
But, sorry to cut you.
I would say, I think it is interesting to break down his filmography, because I would say he's gotten obviously less accessible. Like, to me, the cool part about Boogie Nights is that it's such a cinephile movie, but you could absolutely show it to your friends who don't, you know, watch these weird indie movies all the time, and they would totally dig it. It's a fun ride. Whereas I don't think the same thing for The Master or Phantom Thread. They're harder, you know, they're more difficult to watch.
Even There Will Be Blood, I think, is kind of inaccessible.
Well, it's on the teeter there, because it's like, I think that there's obviously, you know, it starts with like 20 minutes of silence, you know, and or something like that. Like, so there's that kind of stuff going on that's artistic and whatnot. But I still think there's more to for people to master teeth on than a Phantom Thread, and especially an Inherent Vice, which is incomprehensible.
I think Boogie Nights has a lot more going on the surface. I think something like Phantom Thread requires you to do a little bit more of the work.
Absolutely.
Maybe Inherent Vice is the same, but I don't think that aspect of his work is necessarily relegated to any one portion of his career, because I think that Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love in some ways are really dense and nuanced, and they kind of make you lean in the same way that I think Punch Drunk Love has a much cleaner, well, you know, pun not intended, a much cleaner thread between Punch Drunk Love and Phantom Thread than something like Boogie Nights and Phantom Thread.
Maybe, but you got Adam Sandler there.
I like Punch Drunk Love. I apologize. All I'm saying is that I think that you're absolutely right that Boogie Nights is much more accessible than a lot of his latter career stuff, but I don't think that's necessarily because it's earlier in his career. That's the only point.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, to me, it's a very interesting choice to basically make these movies that he did in his early career, which to me, you know, are firing on all cylinders like that, and then to kind of very deliberately say, you know, I'm going to make essentially a movie for him that is, harder to grasp onto, which, like I'm saying, I'm not dogging on that. But I always, every time I go into a new movie, I'm always like, God, I hope that this is like one of his, I hope this is like Boogie Nights. I'm sorry, I can't help but do that. And I think that Soggy Bottom, his next movie, is going to do that, because it's a fucking 70s high school comedy. It has to.
It's going back to the Valley.
Yeah, it's going back to the Valley. I think that he's probably going to be doing something more along Boogie Nights, hopefully. And, you know, not doesn't have to be exactly, but anyway.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so let's do a quick recap here, and this is going to be a very brief recap because there's a lot of different storylines, and I'm not going to address that in the recap, but I'm sure we'll talk about them as we kind of dissect the film a little bit. So basically, here it is. Simple story. High school dropout Eddie Adams is working in the kitchen of a nightclub when he's discovered by Jack Horner, a big porn filmmaker. Eddie wants to be a star, but has never really had an in, so to speak. However, he is gifted. He's got a big old piece of pipe, and Jack finds this out and then hires Eddie, who later changes his name to Dirk Diggler. Dirk becomes the biggest male porn star in the world, picking up awards, fame, and money along the way. Jack, however, fancies himself as an artist and wants to do something a little bit more. He wants to make a real film with a real story, so they all decide to make a series of action-themed porn films, with Dirk starring alongside friend and colleague Reed. The fame ends up eventually going to Dirk's head a bit, and he and Reed get deeper and deeper into drugs. This leads to mood swings and prevents Dirk from even being able to get aroused, making it difficult for him to do his job. So he ends up lashing out at Jack, tries to fight him a little bit, so Jack fires him. And then Dirk and Reed say, screw all this madness, and we're going to try to start a music career, but that's unsuccessful. They end up running out of money, so they go deeper and deeper into the drug world. Things downward spiral more for Dirk, leading him and Reed to almost getting gunned down at one point by a local drug dealer. But eventually, Dirk comes back to Jack, groveling, asking for forgiveness, and he receives this forgiveness, being welcomed back into the fold. As I said, this is a very brief recap. We didn't talk about Don Cheadle's character, we didn't talk about Amber, but these are all important things that we need to talk about, and we will do on the other side of an ad. But I gotta give a shout out to this week's sponsor, Skillshare. Look, everybody, you've heard me talk about Skillshare. Skillshare is legit. It's an online learning community where you can connect with other like-minded people and creatives, and where you can explore projects that you're passionate about. And this is why Skillshare is so cool, because you can unleash your creativity and pursue passions right from the convenience of your home. I know that everyone is kind of teetering on lockdowns. We're in, we're out. I'm personally in the middle of a big lockdown here in Sydney, which we hadn't had before. I know some people in the States are coming out of lockdowns, but some cities are getting back into lockdowns, so it can be really difficult to connect, especially if you are a creative. This is why Skillshare is great, because that community is right there at your fingertips. All you have to do is be able to get online and sign up for one of their packages. And if you sign up for their premium membership, you can get a free trial by going to Skillshare.com/SMTM. That is, if you want the premium membership, we can give you a free trial by going to Skillshare.com/SMTM, or you can click the link down in the show notes, and you can take advantage of classes on iPhone photography, drone filming, editing, learning how to improve your productivity, videos for Instagram, art activism, etc., 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 etc. So go to Skillshare.com/SMTM or click the link down in the show notes and you get a free trial of their premium membership. All right, let's talk more about Boogie Nights. So we've been talking a little bit about PTA. So let's just do this. Let's do the total film geek thing. What makes this film so freaking good? Remember how I said, like, it's easy to kind of almost take it for granted that it's so good because you watch it and then you're like, oh shit, yeah, most people can't make films like that. Why? What does he do? What does he do? Like, what is the magic that he is able to conjure by doing things that maybe the average filmmaker would not be able to do? Ryan, what do you think?
I think it's what I learned a lot from just listening to him talk and stuff is, and kind of like I alluded to at the beginning, is he puts so much faith in the act and just basically casting, you know, like it's just how important casting is. Like he has this incredible stable of actors in this movie, John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Burt Reynolds, you know, all just giving the performance of their lives. And yeah, they had good material and he probably knows that he has good material, but it's like, okay, he's figured out as much as he can on his own. And he's just obviously a very creative person. So that's a big part of it. But then trusting your actors, knowing and working with them. And then really like, you know, they say 90% of good directing is casting. I think Robert Altman said that or something like that, which is also Robert Altman's DNA is all over this movie.
Yeah. I was going to say this is very Altman-esque. Yeah.
Yeah. Big ensemble. Well,
he was kind of mentored by Altman. Yeah, Altman.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
Is that an AFI connection or
what's that?
Was that an AFI connection or was that kind of,
I can't remember exactly how he got linked up with Robert Altman. P.T. Anderson's dad, Ernie Anderson, was kind of, he was a pretty well-known voice actor. So he sort of just existed in these circles. I know that late in Altman's life and career, like P.T. Anderson was on set for much of Prairie Home Companion to take on a lot of the directing duties when Robert Altman wasn't doing so well. Mm. So they had a pretty close working relationship, and you can definitely see, like you were saying, Ryan, you can definitely see Altman's influence, especially on these early ensemble pictures like this in Magnolia.
Totally. Mm. And yeah. So yeah, I would, and also you got to remember that the first script of this was way different. Right, it was a hard NC-17, like tons of, you know, fucking everything. It was like, yeah, it was way more sex, full frontal sex in the movie, which is unbelievable when you think about the final product. Because I'm amazed how kind of little of the sex they sprinkle in, but how well it's executed. Like, you know, that awesome scene of the first scene when the first sex scene, and it's really just push-ins on people's faces for 99% of it. You know, you get a little bit at the beginning of them getting ready, and then you're watching the reactions. And when I first saw that movie, that was kind of where I was like, got really on board, because I'm like, wow, that's such an interesting way to shoot this, you know, sex scene, is everyone just watching it and their amazement at the performance that Mark Wahlberg is giving.
Watching them.
And yeah. Then they go literally into the camera. It's just doing all sorts of cool camera stuff. And so, yeah, like it's amazing that there was way more sex and that wasn't planned from the beginning. That's not by design, you know. So he's just such a good director in terms. He's seen all these movies, obviously, and references that he can probably be like, okay, I have to make it an R-rated movie. And he's creative enough to still run with it and make it cool and make it seem like it was planned from the beginning. So. Great material, great acting, and then just a creative guy. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to describe.
Yeah. Well, real quick, before I kick it to Raymond, I just want to say, kind of piggybacking off of that, maybe one of the things that unites all of those things, except for maybe casting, is something that you don't really have control over. You kind of relinquish the control quite a bit. But he also seems to have a really strong point of view. So when you're talking about that sex scene, the film isn't about sex, was what it sounds like the first draft maybe of the film, the NC-17 version, would have been. The film would have been about sex. This film is about our perceptions of the sex industry or our consumption of certain performative acts on camera. So when you get that opening scene, you get everybody looking at it. You know, you've got William H. Macy's character who probably is looking with some kind of disgust and maybe guilt and shame because he's embarrassed by his own sexual prowess in relation to his wife who's sleeping with other men, and, you know, he's in the industry and maybe he's feeling some sort of like Maybe he's emasculated before Dirk Diggler, right? But then you also get the shots into the camera, right? Like you're actually looking at the image upside down in the camera, and then shots of the reel of the film kind of running out on the camera. So it's about the filming of the sex scene rather than it being about the sex per se, which is, again, Paul Thomas Anderson making a statement about the film industry, right? Or about the creation of art, right? Which Jack then fancies himself as an artist. So I think it's also that really strong perspective that he takes on it in dealing with the subject matter that might kind of deal with what you're addressing. But yeah, go ahead, Raymond. What were you going to say? Oh yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I can't remember.
Okay.
I was just going to say, to piggyback on what you're saying, that, that, and it's the fact that he knows the audience is like, in their mind, it's like, yeah, the sex is on the front of our minds, because it's like, this is such a weird scene. Just imagine being in that room with those people that are just having sex. But it's cool how he downplays the sex, because it's like, all right, I know that, you know, that's what the audience is thinking, but I'm going a different route. And you're just kind of almost seeing how the laissez-faire nature of what these people do every day. And like you alluded to, how they're a family and stuff at the beginning, you really get that by the end, how these people are united by this weird industry that they're in. And it attracts these weird characters, and he does such a good job of bringing that out cinematically.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting ambivalence regarding their relationship with Dirk Diggler, where he is, or Eddie Adams, whatever you prefer, where he is, like, they have that great, who plays the colonel again, the older guy?
I can't remember the actor, yeah.
Yeah, me neither. Right.
I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, I'll have to look it up. Where he's first introduced to him in that early pool party scene, and he goes, yes, may I see it? And he, Eddie takes his dick out, and you just see the guy's face, and he's just staring down for what seems like an eternity with his mouth slightly agape. And then he like looks up and goes, why, thank you, Eddie.
Yeah. Just like, and then after he says, why, thank you, the camera still just holds on him for about like a good 3 to 4 seconds. And I'm like, is he thinking cha-ching in his head? Or is he thinking like, oh my God, yeah, that's a marvel of nature? Like, what is he thinking, you know?
And there is this, you know, a lot of the time it's played for laughs. Like, for example, Ryan, you were talking about that first scene that he's performing with Julianne Moore, where everyone is just kind of like standing in awe of it. I think like Philip Seymour Hoffman almost drops his boom pole.
Yeah.
but there's something interesting that the movie kind of keeps driving at, that like he is weirdly sort of, he is successful almost in spite of himself, like in spite of Eddie Adams. Like, people are essentially, I remember this anecdote about Clint Eastwood directing a scene, and Clint Eastwood is known for just being very like perfunctory on set.
One,
if you
done,
hit your marks and get your lines right and everything's in focus and, you know, yada yada yada, like if we don't need another take, we're not doing another take. So get your performance locked in that first or second take. And there's this story of him, I can't remember on what movie, I'll have to look this up and maybe post it on Twitter afterwards, but there was one actor who was cast to like hand Matt Damon an envelope, or whoever the star of the movie was. And Clint Eastwood relates this anecdote about her kind of deciding that, like, oh, this walk-on role where she just hands a person an envelope was going to be her Academy Award play. And that she comes in and she sort of like half extends it, and then she pulls it back, and she has like a worried look on her face as she's holding the envelope. She looks down at it, and then she sort of timidly hands it forward with a look of regret. And he just kind of like cuts, and then he pulls her aside and goes, hey, I can't tell you how much this movie is not about you. And if I could have just hired your arm, I would have. And you get this sense, not to jump too far ahead, obviously, like this, I'm going to jump to the very end, so spoiler alert. But I think, you know, in a great movie, the ending is always the film's conceit. And I think there's something very telling in the final frame of this picture, that while there is a sense of hopefulness and there is this sense of family and community that pervades the entire film, the fact that Dirk Diggler's head is completely out of the frame when he pulls out the prosthetic penis And that's what the movie ends on. That, and as he's saying, I'm a star, I'm a big bright shining star. You get this notion that like, oh, this is actually pretty grim, because this guy's head is so fucking useless. He's too stupid to realize the thing that makes him special is like, if Burt Reynolds could just hire his fucking dick, he probably would. And like, when you watch it in that framework, it is one of those things where by the end of it, it's good to see everyone else kind of like sort of finding their footing again. But you do have this sense that like, yeah, Eddie's probably going to fuck this up for himself again. Like it's just one of those things. He seems like he's kind of on a collision course.
Is this like a tragic ending then? Because we know that the actor that Dirk Diggler is based off of is John Holmes, who tragically dies of AIDS after knowingly infecting multiple people. We don't know how many people, but with AIDS, right? So John Holmes is not exactly some sort of heroic figure. Like, this isn't like, I'm a star, like, fuck yeah. This is like him trying to tell himself that he's a star so that he can get it up, maybe. I don't know. It's like, you know, there's that poster on his wall that says American Dream. It's like, all he wants is to be a star. So the question is he happy in his successes, or is this really a story about like finding family, finding a place even in the midst of a difficult world? Because like what's going on there? What do we think?
Absolutely, this is a movie about family. I mean, like, all of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies are in some way or another about someone grappling either with their lack of a father figure or their reunion with a father. Like, every single one of his main characters up to a point, I think maybe Inherent Vice stresses this theory a little bit, but most of his movies are about characters who are trying to fill a paternal void in their lives, whether it's, you know, Eddie Adams in this, who clearly sees Jack Horner as a surrogate father. His first movie, John C. Reilly, sees Philip Baker Hall as a surrogate father. Punch Drunk Love, Adam Sandler's, you know, paternal void is filled by a bunch of hen-pecking sisters. It's like Magnolia is probably the most obvious one. I think PTA even says that's his most autobiographical film. So I do think that this is like absolutely 100% about family, and there is a lot of hopeful optimism at the end of it for other members of the family,
everyone else,
and maybe even Eddie himself. But the movie never gives you the sense that he is like, he's always able to land on his feet because he's able to retreat to these people who are willing to commodify the thing that makes him special within their market, essentially. Like, and that's the one thing that makes me think, like, you know, it could be hopeful. Maybe he could keep a good head screwed onto his shoulders, but you just don't know. Like I said, he is, I think that ending scene, or rather that final frame, would imply that he has up to this point been successful in spite of his, of, you know, what makes him, his head, because he thinks what makes him is dick. So yeah. I don't know. I think in some ways it is tragic, certainly for Dirk Diggler, but it's certainly, you know, it's kind of a poison chalice, like, finding this community that welcomes you but is also willing to like enable the darkest parts of you just so that they can commodify the one thing of yours that they're able to really like glom onto, and you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Sorry for rambling.
Oh no, it was interesting. I was gonna say, because I that, to me, that's an interesting take at basically everything you just said. I would push back though on, I think that it's a not tragic ending, in the sense that the key is and the thing that you said about that he only wants his dick, maybe at the beginning of the relationship, but to me the nice sweet thing at the end is literally Burt Reynolds forgiving him on his doorstep, and when he comes back sobbing, you know, there's no reason for him to take him back.
The prodigal son returns,
and it's just like he could have absolutely just said, look, you're nothing to me now. You're a washed up porn actor. Like, get out of here. There's the next hot kids in town. But to me, the fact that he's still shooting a porn at the end, and it's like, yeah, you're my son. You're my, you know, I love you. Like, of course, let's work together in spite of all this. And so I love that about it, because to me, I do think that the main theme is family. However, I will say that I think that you are supposed to take from the him standing up and showing his dick is a little bit how deluded he is in his mind. You know, it's like any and so it is in that way. It is a little sad. Like he's, you know, he's kind of got the Sunset Boulevard syndrome where he's just like, gonna, you know, he can see himself. He's already seen himself get replaced, but now it's like he's at the twilight of his career and he has to just pump himself up, you know, to make himself this thing he used to be. So in that sense, it's almost like a cautionary tale about fame and stuff and whatever that I think that they're leaving you with to kind of just twist the really sweet Beach Boys medley you just had with all the characters coming back.
Right.
So I think it is both in a way, but I think overall I leave that movie very happy. Like, man, these guys are doing what they love. They're hanging out. They're a family. Yeah, they're weird and fucked up in the head, but so are we all. And this is great. I don't go, man, he's just going to fuck this up again. And that's really the message PTA wanted to send me.
Yeah. And I don't think the movie is necessarily saying that. I'm just saying there is an implication that this could go either way.
Sure.
Because it also bears mentioning that Eddie's not the only person who's down on his luck at that point. You know, Jack is kind of washed up, or at least he feels as though he's been deprived of his sort of mojo with regards to having to transition to video. His traditional financier is now in prison, so he's having to kind of like make a deal with the devil with Philip Baker Hall, who's a big proponent of what's his name, Floyd Gondoli, such a great name, who's such a big proponent of videotape. You know, there is this sense that, like, yes, it ends on an optimistic note on the surface, but there is still the implication that as much as I do think there is a genuine fondness and even love between these characters, there still is a sense, though, that Jack may be using Eddie as much as Eddie is using Jack by the end of the film, because, oh, I've kind of lost my mojo, and I know that when we were really clicking, he was my muse. If I can get him back in front of the camera, maybe we can make a go out of this thing again, even if it is on videotape. Let's make film history on videotape, as he keeps saying during what's the segment that he does with Roller Girl on the prowl. It's actually based on an original, or not an original. It's based on a thing that was called On the Prowl, where there were porn producers who would do that with video cameras back in the day. But I can't remember what they call it in the movie itself. My mind is blanking right now. But apologies. I only bring that up to say, Ryan, I don't think the movie is necessarily a tragic ending, but I do think there are enough seeds planted to suggest that, like, well, they may not be out of the woods yet. You know, there are still tough times ahead for this industry and, by extension, these characters.
Well, and this is right before the AIDS epidemic, too, which is why I brought up John Holmes earlier, right? So if this is the transition from late 70s into early 80s here, this is right before that happens, which is going to ravage or at least affect the film industry in a lot of ways. I think a couple other themes that are interesting that we can think about. One that is, you know how we had like the meta alarm, and we used to have like a problematic alarm. I think we should add like a Freudian or Oedipal alarm. So every time there's like a fucking Freudian theme and I bring it up, the alarm bells should be going off, because it isn't even subtle in this fucking movie, okay? Like, clearly he refers, I mean, Jack is referred to as Daddy, and Amber is referred to as Mommy. And there's the scene when he's brought back, the prodigal son returns, Dad embraces, and then there's the scene of Eddie Dirk crying in Amber's lap as she's consoling him like a mother would, except the difference is that he's having sex with his mother throughout the film, on camera and I believe off camera too. So, you know, there is definitely some pretty heavy Oedipal themes that are being explored as well. And I think what's really interesting is you take that family, the Jack, Amber, Dirk triangle, and you juxtapose that with Eddie's family, which is the mom who is very harsh and very condescending, and then the father who is very sort of demure and non-assertive in any way. And then you really get this like juxtaposition of that family life into this other family life, which makes you understand why this film in some ways is hopeful, because he finds a place where he didn't have a place before. You know, he had a family that was very difficult They didn't accept him. He didn't have a father figure, really, somebody he could look up to, right? And then all of a sudden, he does find that. Now, whether or not we think that that is the right, quote-unquote, type of family to ethically raise a child is something that the film kind of explores, like right, that we can kind of reserve judgment on, because there's also that interesting storyline with Amber, who is dealing with her own custody issues, with her own biological son, right? Not the sort of adopted family of the porn world, right? And how she's not able to have custody of the son because of what she does. But then she's also able to fulfill her role in the mother space, subject position almost, in that family. So she too is able to have a place, even though in her kind of like her own marriage didn't work out and her relationship with her son is estranged because of this industry, the industry also gives her a home. So there's some really interesting kind of tensions that I think this film presents by giving us these various
concepts.
And
that's mirrored by Don Cheadle's arc near the end of the film as well. Like that's one of the, I think, the masterstrokes in this movie, and I've talked about this before, so apologies if I'm just a sucker for this in film, is that these characters are judged by other characters within the universe of the film, but they're never judged by the filmmakers. And you do see a degree to which Amber's sort of the void in her life is filled by these folks who are emotionally receptive to her. And you see that with Don Cheadle as well, that there's kind of like a karmic rebalancing that after he is dismissed by the bank, who focuses on, you know, we can't be in business with a pornographer. And then he goes, and there's that insanely like traumatizing sequence in the donut shop. But he ends up leaving with the money that he needed to open up Buck's super stereo store, or whatever he calls it. So there is this weird way in which I think this movie sometimes gets a bad rap for being judgmental of its characters or reducing them to sort of caricatures or stereotypes of this industry, or punishing them as a result of their impropriety or perceived societal impropriety. But I actually think it's quite the opposite. There seems to be like a karmic balancing that, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson sort of like steps in and hands him the money through this sheer force of coincidence, which is something that he goes on to explore in like every single other one of his movies. I mean, Magnolia is the text with that, like how obsessed he is with just circumstance and coincidence. Hard Eight also has touches of that with like the thing about John C. Reilly's matches in his pocket lighting on fire. He does have these weird things that just seem like random moments of the universe, either punishing people or calling them in one direction or another. But in this one, I think it's definitely utilized to reward these folks in a society that has otherwise spurned them.
Hmm. Really, yeah, I think I'd add that on to another reason I love this movie and think this movie is so cool, is like it's weirdly indulgent, like but in a good way, like that donut shop scene is, you know, that would get cut in another movie before it even got shot. People would be like, do we really need this to tell the story? You know what I mean? But like, no, Paul Thomas Anderson's telling this 3-hour epic opus, you know, and he will go on these tangents, you know, even the William H. Macy wonders where he's going, you know, finding the wife and stuff. That's a really awesome scene that really fleshes out his character. It's super tragic, but like that scene, you know, just how he shoots it and everything, it's also unique and works together. But I think that it's contrary to a lot of mainstream movies that would be made like this. I don't know. They would just cut that shit out.
Well, it adds a texture.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, like when you read all the fucking screenwriting books, it's like, does this scene push the protagonist's narrative forward in an explicit way, da 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 da. But one of the things that this scene, like let's take for example the Bill Macy scene where he looks for his wife, goes out, gets the gun, and then shoots her, and then kind of kills himself or whatever. One of the things that these films, or that these scenes do, is they add texture to what it is that this film is kind of presenting in terms of its concepts, right? About like masculinity, about sexual prowess, about, you know, this is also a time where you have an industry, the porn industry, industry that is oftentimes viewed from a feminist lens as allowing women to have control over their pleasure and how pleasure is pursued in bodily autonomy, right? So there's actually a really interesting essay that I just want to give a quick shout out to. It's on open access, so it's on like a digital comment or Creative Commons. It's called Historical Omission and Psychic Repression in Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights by Tanya Modleski. I'll probably tweet it out, but just if you Google any of those words, if you're interested, the author basically goes into a lot of these other themes and actually coins the term male weepies. And says that this film is actually like a form of weepy cinema, like male weepy cinema, where you have this like melancholic figure that is being explored through like the loss of a fantasy. And what is it that's lost? It's in this like act of psychic repression about male virility, control over sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. And this is one of the themes that the film explores. This essay is critical of the film, but I think we don't need to necessarily rush to such a criticism, and I'd rather just kind of like present this as something that we can think about, to explore as these ideas that are out there that we can kind of dig through thinking about this. And then one of the other themes that we have to mention is the issue of how homosexuality is treated in this film, because you have Philip Seymour Hoffman's character who makes a pass at Eddie, and Eddie is I don't know fully how to read that scene. Is Eddie, like, disgusted, like, I'm not gay, don't try it? Or is it more like, dude, what are you doing? Like, come on, I'm not into you? Or, like, what's going on there? Like, is he trying to distance himself from the gay person? Which then makes it interesting when later he gets beaten, gay-bashed, quote-unquote, by that group of people. And then we're meant to kind of feel sorry for him. And maybe even empathize with the homosexual community, but this is also a figure who distanced himself from that identity position. So again, there's some interesting points of tension here that the film is kind of presenting to us, and I think that fits into the industry at that time, right? Into the social landscape at that time as well.
Yeah, I think you just said it. He loves the character Philip Seymour Hoffman plays as a friend, and he was obviously confused about what he did. But yeah, there was totally an element of "I'm not gay," you know, kind of thing going on. Like, what are you doing? You know, but probably if it wasn't his buddy, he probably would have had a way more extreme, you know, maybe even physical reaction. You know, is the way I read it.
Yeah, possibly. I think Dirk in this movie is portrayed as someone who is comfortable with the like the notion of homosexuality, or at least at the very least he's comfortable, you know, from the moment that Jack meets him in the restaurant, he asks him if he wants to watch him masturbate. Like, he has performed you know, sexual acts in front of men before, like with the explicit notion of pleasing them. So it is one of those things that's kind of like, this is something the porn industry still struggles with today, is this sort of like latent homophobia. I think that he may not necessarily have any problems with Scotty's sexuality. He may be surprised or disturbed by it, or he may just feel uncomfortable having that affection turned towards him, because most, at least from the moment that he gets involved with Burt Reynolds and the whole crew, all of the, you know, the romantic or intimate scenes are totally commodified, whether it's him and Roller Girl on the couch so that Jack can, you know, quote unquote, see him in action, or in front of the camera while they're filming. You know, the only time that we see like an earnest off-camera moment of intimacy, at least I'm maybe unfairly conflating intimacy with sexual, with sex acts, is when he's with his girlfriend at his parents' place before he, you know, before he meets, or maybe it's after he meets him, but you know what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
So I think it's one of those things that he may not necessarily, the film may not necessarily be implying that he's uncomfortable with Scotty's sexuality, but he may just be not expecting it in that moment. He may be, you know, turned off by the notion of having like that kind of intimacy with a man, while when it's more performative, he's more open to it. Personally, have you seen the Dirk Diggler story, the short film on which this is based?
No.
A while ago, I forget it though.
in that short, he's explicitly bisexual. And I think that there's something that Paul Thomas Anderson is trying to accomplish by switching from that to this. I think it is, you know, obviously a deliberate choice. He has entertained the notion of this character within as a bisexual person rather than a sort of heteronormative figure. I think that as it's portrayed in this movie, it could be seen as problematic, but you also have scenes between him and Scotty later in the movie. Like, Scotty is hanging around when they're planning to rip off Alfred Molina in one of the greatest scenes in film history.
That's fucking great.
But I think that his relationship continuing with him after that sort of implies that he's not, like, all of a sudden uncomfortable with Scotty. It may just be one of those things where he's not comfortable with, like, earnest, intimate homosexuality. Maybe he's only comfortable with it in a performative or commodified sense, but it's definitely a minefield that they're negotiating with.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But can we give a props to Marky Mark's performance in that for the whole movie? But just like even then he's like, why'd you do that, Scotty? Why'd you do this?
I gotta give all props to Mark Wahlberg because I enjoy Mark Wahlberg as a cultural figure. I don't always love him as an actor, okay?
But in this movie.
Like, in this movie, though, is fucking perfect. That you just did a great impression, Ryan, with his voice. That he kind of, that's his, like, go-to a lot of times. That kind of tone. And I don't know. I don't always love him, right? Like I love him in doses. But in this film, I think it's fucking perfect. It's because he's this bright-eyed, kind of, like, almost naively, I don't know. There's something so youthful about him. And it just fits kind of perfectly. And I love it. But I don't always tend to love Marky Mark.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of when he commits, like, hate crimes and shit like that, which was just a couple years before this movie.
Oh, was that a thing? I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
Well, like, 13? I mean, that's one... Right?
I think he was slightly older than that. But it's one of those complicating factors that, like, Mark Wahlberg, by all accounts, doesn't seem like that great of a person. I think he is very well cast in this film. I think PTA's first choice was Leonardo DiCaprio, who was briefly attached but ultimately dropped out to do Titanic. I could see that being an interesting movie, but I do think that Mark Wahlberg is very well cast in this film. I think he has the right energy, that sort of, like, naivete and...
I couldn't see it being with anybody else. Like, to me, he is this character, and the thing about it was a huge risk too for his career. Like, he was coming off the huge, you know, Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch and stuff, and I think he'd made the Basketball Diaries before this, maybe. Not much really, though. Maybe made that after. Either way,
well, he disavows this movie now.
Oh yeah, because he's a super Catholic, right? You know, like
yeah, he's super Catholic. That's a superpower,
right?
I am not even going to take that bait because there's just too much to go there. As
I will say, there is one more thing before you transition, Austin. I will say there is one thing that I think is kind of interesting that he is doing. Maybe he's not doing this consciously with Mark Wahlberg's persona, because I think this was on the page before he ever cast Mark Wahlberg, but there is kind of a telling sort of aspect of his psychology in this, that he's constantly telling Jack, like, it's not sexy when guys are rough with girls on camera and blah blah blah. We got to be sexy. And then it shows footage of him as Brock Landers. And this is, like, the character he conceived of as, like, the sexy alternative to, you know, the Johnny Wads of the world who comes in later in the movie. And there's just a clip of him as Brock Landers that I think is sort of spliced into a montage where he's just, like, towering over a woman and he goes, "Shut the fuck up or I'll hit you in the goddamn face." And you're just like, okay, so clearly his ambitions of being, like, he has a very different notion of like, oh, it's not sexy to be rough with women. It's not sexy to abuse them or assault them and blah, blah, blah. And then like two movies later, he's completely assimilated that sense of you know, sexuality or dominant sexuality. Mm. And there is something about the character where like there is that boyish earnestness to him and that sort of like eagerness to please. But I also think Paul Thomas Anderson is really, really good at harnessing the darker aspects of his personality as well. But sorry to cut you off there.
No, I was just going to say, before we wrap up and get into a voicemail here, what is a favorite sequence? You mentioned the scene with Alfred Molina. That is a great friggin' scene. So have a think while I'm finishing this sentence as to what your favorite sequence or scene is. Ryan, I think, already has it. Go!
I can't pick my favorite, but him and John C. Reilly's first hangout, where we're just hanging on the two shot of him, and they're both being like, "How much you bench press?" You know? And
that's a great scene.
You like Star Wars? I don't know. It's just like,
have you seen that movie Star Wars? People say I look like Han Solo.
Yeah, you know,
that's a really good John C. Reilly.
I love that. Basically,
love John C. Reilly.
He's so good.
Yeah, I love when they're like, okay, so how much do you bench? We'll go at the same time, and they go 1, 2, 3. You didn't say anything. You didn't say anything either. That's a great little sequence. Yeah.
That is sort of the progenitor of these stepbrothers. Did we just become best friends? Yep.
Yeah.
Also, real quick, I just want to say, John C. Reilly
and Philip Seymour Hoffman, they did a Broadway version of a show that I just recently did a couple months ago called True West. Was it on Broadway or was that the Lincoln Center? I can't remember where it was. It was either Broadway, Off-Broadway, Lincoln Center, something like that. One of the big spaces. And they basically, just a few years after this film was made, so they did a lot of work together in theater as well. So it's kind of amazing to look at this cast and recognize that these people have known each other and worked together on really substantial projects, not just with Paul Thomas Anderson and other things like we've mentioned, but also with one another. So there's like this community, there's this family thing that that I think also comes through what PTA is doing, because maybe he has a family, right? Like maybe his own personal, I don't know about his personal life, maybe his own personal family has some things that were lacking, but he's found a family or he's created a family in the art community. So this scene that you're talking about kind of makes me think about that, because that's such a brotherly type of relationship. But Raymond, favorite sequence or scene?
Well, I mentioned Alfred Molina. That one's really, really tough to beat. But I also think that just to give some credit to Heather Graham, the On the Prowl sequence that's shot on videotape.
Yeah,
and it's just those really long unbroken takes. And when that guy is sitting across the car from her, the limo from her, and he's saying like, I think her name is Brandy. It's the only time that we hear her as anything other than Roller Girl. And he says something like, your name's Brandy, right? We went to school together, blah, blah, blah. And just like, she's doing so much with absolutely no dialogue. And then when she finally pipes up, she just kind of says like, no, that's not me. And then she's sort of like looking at Burt Reynolds to like, are you going to bail me out here? Like,
yeah.
And I think that this movie does sometimes get criticism, maybe not unfairly, with its portrayal of women. But I do think that there is an honesty to the manner in which Heather Graham is portrayed or positioned within this film as, once again, a commodity within this industry. Mm. And her humanity is like constantly being denied to her. And even in that sequence where she has like this sort of father figure next to her who can't even like recognize how awkward this might be for her, and she's like looking straight down the barrel of the camera, and the way that videotape is kind of like has the light tracers because of how it's transferred, it's just one of those really well conceived sequences, and I think she's phenomenal in it. She doesn't get enough credit as an actor.
Well, I mean, I think we can all agree this is a fantastic film. If you haven't seen it, definitely go see it. If it's been a long time since you've seen it, give it a rewatch. And if you've got any sort of cool, interesting remarks or comments that you want to shoot at us, you can do so by calling us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. Or you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. We don't have a ton of time, but I do want to get to one voicemail. So, Producer Matt, cue up whichever of the voicemails you want. Ryan, hold that thought. We'll close it with it on the other side of the voicemail. We'll have it be like a final, like a post little epilogue thing that we'll
get
to.
Well, I wanted to hear your scene. I don't think you said a scene, right?
Was the pool scene.
Oh, okay.
The pool scene, right, where they, I just love the vibe. It creates the feeling of that world, and I feel like it's so immersive.
Cuba sequence, though, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's so fantastic because it makes me feel that, and I actually love the opening shot where it just kind of goes up the sign that says Reseda, and I actually laughed to myself because I was like, oh, Reseda, like, I used to hang out in that area, you know, when I was younger in the San Fernando Valley. I had friends from tennis camp.
Introducing all the characters. And,
I love the way the camera moves. So those types of sequences, I love a long take anyway, especially if it's on Steadicam. It's one of my favorite things in the entire world if it's done well. So that's my favorite. Okay, one more.
Last shot. I want to say, just because it's so awesome and it kind of encapsulates how much I love him as a director, is just when Julianne Moore, who we've seen the whole time, is this amazing, you know, she's a fun loving mom figure and stuff, and then we see the courtroom scene and her losing custody of her kids and stuff like that or whatever, and then that shot of her outside the courthouse, which is from across the street, you're seeing all the cars that are going in and out of the foreground, and she's just bawling her eyes out. Like, I think about that shot a lot because it's just kind of in the middle. It's such a sad moment that, you know, really gives all this depth to her character in the middle of a fun movie. And it's a different, you know, it's a documentary style shot almost in a movie with all these controlled, very precise Steadicam shots. So the fact, that's just an example of him being a good director and just like knowing when to switch it up and knowing when to hold and knowing when to do these oners and all that stuff.
Even in a 3-hour movie, there are so many instances just like that of just phenomenal economical editing.
Yeah.
Like that keeps this baby moving. It doesn't feel like 3 hours. But can we keep talking about this for 2 hours?
I know. Right. That's the thing. I actually have ahead. I have like 6 other things that I wanted to discuss, and we're not even gonna get to them. So I'm sure we'll come back to, you know what we need to do? We need to just torture Ryan and do Inherent Vice just so we can fucking talk
about
it.
Oh my god, no. I would love to have an hour where I can rant for an hour on that fucking movie. Fucking him. Thank you. I would welcome that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Okay.
We should definitely do more Paul Thomas Anderson, whatever we do.
We absolutely have to. Let's queue up one of the voicemails, and then we'll close on one of that one. So if you want to call us, you can call us 1-213-534-8807. Leave us a voicemail. Leave us your thoughts. What do we got this week to listen to?
Hello, Wallace Boone, longtime Wisecrack listener. The reason I called in, well, you guys asked for people to call in the voicemail, and I decided to be that person. Well, I'm calling in about your recent talk about Suicide Squad. One interesting thing I feel like you guys didn't really touch on about the movie is, well, the whole idea of the Suicide Squad is that people are disposable. All the bad guys that they put in the movie, you know, they slaughter them left and right. And in turn, those bad guys also treat human lives as disposable. But in a very ham-fisted way, they show that the theme of the movie, that even the most lowly and, like, despicable people of humanity also have value. Like Taika Waititi basically says it. So I think it's interesting how these two things are juxtaposed in the movie, right? All these people who are shown to be, like, disposable, dying all the time, but saying that every single person has values. And I feel like that's a very mixed message in the movie. And I don't know, like, you know, like, I feel like there's something there, you know, like, what are people in the world of Suicide, are they good or are they bad at their core? Like, even like Amanda Waller and all the people who work for her in the government, you know, like, they're shown to be pretty terrible people at the beginning of the movie, betting on who's going to live and die. And, you know, Amanda's Waller acts and speak for herself. But they are the same people who, like, her workers, the same one who knocked out Amanda Waller and, you know, allow the Suicide Squad to save innocent people. So, I don't know. Do you guys have anything smart to say about that? Thanks for taking my call. Love listening to you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much. What do you think? Is there a mixed message in Suicide Squad? What is it saying about the nature of humanity?
I think that Suicide Squad, I think the guy was totally right. But what it's almost like Seinfeld or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, or it's one of those things where it's like, all right, everybody in this movie is an asshole. There literally is not asshole in the bunch, but we're seeing, you know, what makes them tick and that they're human beings too. Like, I thought that James Gunn did a pretty good job of mixing those two vibes and really making you feel like, all right, yeah, these people will do anything to survive, including killing their best friends and turning on people or whatever, you know, or killing all these other indiscriminately, and they're doing it for selfish reasons, but they also there's love in there somewhere too. So I think that is part of the message.
Raymond, what do you think, brother?
I think there's some bad folks doing good things by the end of the day.
Yeah.
And, that's always compelling on screen. They make very fun, anti-heroes. You know, we covered some of this on our episode. We appreciate the call, but, I think it's as simple as that. They're not great people. They may not even be good people, but they find it within themselves to do the right thing when it matters the most. And, you know, that's always going to be compelling. Or not necessarily always, but it's a winning formula if you do it right.
To get meta and stuff, you know, do you think that the movie's saying anything about forgiveness and whatnot? Like, can people that have, you know, what makes a bad person? Is it that I've done all redemption. This bad stuff? Or can a person change, you know, like him and his daughter and stuff? Is there anything, once you've done all this bad stuff, are you just a worthless piece of shit forever? You know, like, or does it matter, you know, if you do the right thing at all at some point? Like, I think that those are all present in the movie too.
It's always, I'm about to butcher a famous quote. There's never a bad time to do the right thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm paraphrasing. I can't remember where I heard that.
I'll put my philosophy professor hat on for just 20 seconds here and say there's some really interesting themes of justice in this film. Punitive justice is kind of typical of, like, retribution, right? Like, eye for an eye type of logic. And that's what we're accustomed to in countries like the United States and in much of the Western world. But there are other forms of justice, rehabilitative justice and restorative justice, that allow for the possibility of what Ryan just said, for forgiveness, for redemption, for assimilating somebody back into society, for teaching, for correction, for training. And I would just say that when we encounter a film like this, what we can do is we can really put our critical thinking hats on and not be so quick to try to rush to, are these good guys versus bad guys? But really, that binary itself, we can deconstruct and we can say, well, what is goodness in relation to the service of what? Because clearly, you know, John Cena's character was doing the good thing by serving the interests of the Empire. But is that good, or was Bloodsport good by kind of doing the opposite, by actually defying the orders of the authority, right? So who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? What is the good thing? What is the bad thing? These are tensions that we can always wrestle with, and I think it's good to sometimes just sit there and hold them. And we can't keep talking because we are like 10 minutes late, and I just opened a whole can of worms.
No, to tie it back into Boogie Nights, it all starts with acknowledging the humanity of others.
Yeah.
And like I said before, not judging the characters, whether they be on screen or off screen. You know, just look for the humanity.
10 seconds.
Now, Ryan, you tag
the only reason I said I forgot to even finish the tag on why I brought the meta part up, and that was because, you know, I've seen people even allude to this, that like it mirrors James Gunn's little controversy from a couple years ago. You know what I mean? Like, it's like is he a piece of shit because he made all these incendiary tweets forever ago and stuff. So I don't know. There's a whole, like, whatever you want to call it, forgiveness canceling, I don't know, meta theme I think you could take from that movie if you were to dig deep far enough.
This is the messy stuff of living as humans in society. That's what I have to say.
All right. We are in a society.
Let's get out of here. Where can we find you on the internet, Ryan?
Ryan Shorts. I'm releasing them more now, and I'm putting them on Instagram now. I didn't used to, yeah. But I'm getting up with the times. Ryan Shorts.
Finally. Now, when are you going to get on TikTok is the question, because that's the real...
That's my next project.
All right, Raymond, what about you, brother?
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. If you follow me, say hi. Always down to talk about movies.
Sweet. And you can find me, Austin_Hayden, on Twitter, AUS_HAY on Insta. I'm on TikTok, although I haven't uploaded anything lately, but I'm Austin.Hayden. That's pretty much it. Ryan, send us out of here, brother.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California. This has been Show Me the Meanie!